The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Welcome to Spectator Out Loud. I'm Fraser Nelson. Each week, we ask a few of our writers to read their piece from the magazine aloud. In this episode, Arnold Boyrell asks whether it's racist to wonder what colour your child's skin will be. Lionel Shriver says the West has unthinkingly accepted China's totalitarian tactics to suppress the virus. And finally, Melissa Kite, our real-life columnist, describes an infuriating encounter with what she describes as obnoxious Surrey battle axes. I'm not quite sure if it's such a thing, but you can hear her explain why there is. First up, Arnold Boyrell.
Maybe I missed something here. Or maybe I am just completely naive, but why is it racist to ponder what the skin colour of a new baby will be? Well, according to most of the American and British media, post the Harry and Meghan interview, it absolutely is racist. It's horrendous, evil, bigoted, especially so in the US, a country where barely 10% of the married population is actually interracial. But these are the views of people that don't actually know what they're talking about, because they're not part of it or in the slightest bit close to an interracial couple. So, first, the obvious declaration of interest. Me, I was born in Mauritius. I look Asian, or brown if you prefer. My wife was born in Slovenia. She is white and blonde. Yes, it's an unusual match. But our respective families are the most open-minded groups of people you could ever meet. Never a hint of racism on either side. But have we discussed the skin colours of my kids since long before they were born? You bet we have, and still do. Before my son Joe popped out 11 years ago, my late mother inquired endlessly what the different colour options were. She went further than the mystery racist royal, suggesting that a darker version of brown would be better, as the kid would more likely follow the Hindu religion. That's the side of our family. My wife's family, who could not have been more welcoming to the first brown face that ever entered their remote village in Eastern Europe, were hoping for a whiter result, thinking that it made it more likely he would follow Christianity. I joined in with all this. We had endless family discussions, usually over countless bottles of wine. It was all a great guessing game and a damn good laugh. I had a side bet running with some friends on what exact colour Joe would be. I guess that makes me racist too. Joe, as it turned out, came out on the whiter side of white. My mother adored him and promptly joined in the plans for his christening. Second one will be a bit more brown, I hope, she told me. But her hopes were further dashed when my daughter Evita appeared 3 years later, looking a little bit whiter than white than she had hoped. She came to that christening too. Things did become more balanced in 2013 when our third child, Savannah, was born. Definitely on the brown side of brown. My mother was thrilled. I lost another bet. My in-laws found it all very amusing and confusing before we all went to a Hindu temple together. And guess what my close friends did? Exactly what I would have done, made several lurid suggestions about there being no way I could be the father. The colours don't add up, they told me. My kids often point out that within our own family, the five of us are all completely different skin colours. They think it's really cool and even cooler to talk about it. For them, it's a source of positive fascination. When it comes to race and religion, they want to know more, learn more, embrace more. At my daughter's birthday party in February last year in Bolivia, where we live the summer of the year, the guest included an indigenous Indian, a black Brazilian, and a Bolivian of Japanese ancestry. Many languages, many colours, many questions, and many laughs. Did one of the parents go online to see who matched which deluxe paint colour scheme? Yes, guilty as charged. And that makes them racist. Come on, get real. Context is everything. Nobody actually has a clue what the context of the rogue royal remark was regarding Meghan and Harry's unborn baby. We probably never will. But you know what? My kids understand context. My wife does. My in-laws and my friends do. So did my mother. But if you look at everything in black and white, then by my count, there are lots of racists in this story. Me, my wife, my mother, my in-laws, my close friends, the guests at the birthday party, we should all be cancelled. Or maybe we should accept the inconvenient truth, which is that none of my friends or relatives is in the slightest bit racist, and most of us interracial folk like to have a good laugh at our own expense.
That was Anna Boyle. Next, Lionel Shriver.
International travelers running the gauntlet of English airports must already test negative for COVID before the flight, and on return to the UK get tested again before boarding, fill out a locator form, quarantine for 10 days, and test negative twice more. But that's not enough oppression for Boris Johnson's government. As of this week, outbound intrepids have also to fill out declaration forms explaining why their trip is essential. Not doing so is a criminal offense. This new hoop to jump is obnoxious on a host of levels. The declaration form came in on the very day the first few lockdown restrictions were eased, with hospitalizations and deaths dramatically down and more than a third of the adult population vaccinated. Recall how last summer's mask mandate was levied right when infections were at their nadir. The message is clear. Don't believe for a minute this horror show is over. We've assumed total control over your lives down to the nittiest of gritties, and we're not giving it up. According to gov.uk, we would-be passengers may bring supporting documents to justify our wanderlust. The deliberately vague language implies that the decision to allow us to fly will rely on police caprice. Still more bureaucracy will further cripple the airline industry. And the purpose of the form filling is intimidation. If we're at all shaky about whether the purpose of our journey qualifies us for release from HMP UK, the intention is to frighten us out of the notion. I wish this were a non sequitur. I just finished Kai Strittmatter's We Have Been Harmonized, Life in China's Surveillance State. It's a sobering read. Strittmatter notes the many ways in which the West, naively or cynically, plays into the Chinese Communist Party's hands, most conspicuously with the betrayal of democratic values and a failure to live up to the West's own ideals. The author cites Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo as examples of the U.S. using the same police state tactics as the regimes it always condemned. But although this 2019 publication's 2020 paperback has been updated to include the emergence of COVID, the distinguished journalist misses a trick. Liberal democracies do indeed ape the very policies that make China seem such a forbidding, dystopian place to live. But a glaring example is absent. Like much of the West, Britain has navigated this pandemic with heavy-handed state coercion, threats of 10-year imprisonment for not filling in a form properly, fines of £10,000 for organizing a protest of any sort, arbitrary arrest and police harassment for sitting on a park bench or walking a dog in the wilderness. Whatever is not expressly permitted is forbidden. It's the state's business whether we hold our mother's hand. Rule is by decree. Rare parliamentary approval of still more draconian restrictions is a rubber stamp. Dissenting scientific opinion is suppressed. Sledgehammer subtle propaganda goons from hoardings. And broadcast media almost exclusively recapitulate government messaging. The public is encouraged to shop recalcitrant neighbors and relatives to the authorities. Does this sound like somewhere else you know of? Like COVID itself, lockdowns were exported from China, then espoused by the World Health Organization, a once reputable institution, now largely captured by China as well. There were other routes to managing this disease. Reliable, benevolent advice, financial support for at-risk age groups, sequestration of COVID patients in healthcare settings, methods that pandemic preparedness studies already commended. Instead, Most of the West abandoned once sacrosanct principles on a dime, and democratic governments fell all over themselves in their eagerness to copy not only one another, but China. In so doing, our politicians have demoted our civil rights to privileges, ever provisional, readily revoked, restored only if we're terribly good, like children hoping for presents from Santa. So-called rights to free movement, free association, free speech, now resemble the social credits Chinese AI apps award for paying your bills and refraining from jaywalking. Thus the West kisses goodbye its last few square inches of moral high ground. Under stress, the West is demonstrably as authoritarian as the CCP. The supreme ideals of harmony and safety are peas in a pod. What's especially unnerving about the ever more efficient, all-seeing, and all-controlling CCP is the purely mechanical vision of civilization that constitutes this trend's natural endpoint. What's a society for? To work smoothly and frictionlessly like a coffee table widget? To ensure all citizens help the contraption function like securely tightened screws? Science fiction has long capitalized on the Westerner's instinctive horror of a social machine that works too well. Our competing vision has traditionally entailed an element of disorder. Western liberty allows for creativity and even, quietly, the breaking of rules. It's a burden, granted, but in the West, the purpose of our lives is for us each to determine. Altruism is a choice. As China exalts tranquility and obedience, harmony, we now exalt public health. For the past year, we've nobly made personal sacrifices for the perceived well-being of the whole. Meanwhile, all other values have taken a back seat. Friendship, family, curiosity and adventure, art. But health as a value is mechanical. Some advisors of the Johnson government actually want not only mask mandates, but social distancing to remain in effect for the foreseeable. That would indefinitely eliminate household mixing, otherwise known as having a life, an audience for sports, cinema, music, lectures, and all other live performance, festivals of every stripe, financially viable restaurants and pubs, shared religious observance, and extended family celebrations of Christmas, Easter, Passover, or Eid, crowded weddings, funerals, baby showers, and graduations. But who cares? Barring non-COVID calamity, we would be well. Our individual bodies would physically function, even as the larger body politic would continue to sicken. The retired Supreme Court Justice Jonathan Sumption observed mournfully last week that constraints on the state are mere conventions. But a state can do anything, really. And now the British state has done anything. Ask the Chinese or George Orwell. Totalitarianism reliably masquerades as patriotism. Submitting to an authority who knows better is always for our own good.
That was Lionel Shriver, and finally, Melissa Kite.
"Have you had your jab, Marjorie?" said one Surrey lady to another in the queue for takeaway coffee at the chintzy, shabby chic coffee shop. "Oh yes, I've had it for my country," said her friend. "I just can't understand these people who won't have the jab. I mean, how selfish." I looked at them and they looked at me pointedly because they'd already decided what sort of person I was, thanks to the altercation we had all just had. "Marjorie, are you feeling all right after your jab?" said one to the other more quietly. "Well, now you ask, no. I've been rather ill for 2 weeks now. I'm sure it's nothing. Yes, I feel dreadful too. I'm sure it's nothing. Suffice to say that this pair had just been so rude to me, I thought, well, you're serving your country, so shut up and enjoy it. If they don't end this lockdown soon, I'm going to be arrested for a fray. I've already been cautioned for not having an MOT, because a darn COVID MOT extension made me then forget it completely. Because that's criminal, I presume I can't even run away to America now. Lockdown is making a hardened offender of me. Next, I fear some kind of punch-up, resulting in me being led away in handcuffs from the bakery or the shabby chic cafe. In the bakery, they don't seem to like any more than two customers at a time, so we all queue round the block, Soviet Russia style, which is why I didn't question the queue outside the shabby chic cafe opposite the bakery. I just got to the front when the two obnoxious Surrey battle axes swept past me. Excuse me, I said, blocking the doorway. I am queuing to go in. Well, go in then, said the rudest of the two. Well, I would, I said, but there's still people at the counter. So, said the other. So, three women stood glaring at each other outside this chintzy cafe full of dainty homewares, and I'm sure all three of us had murder on our minds. Look here, I hissed, wanting to grab them by the scruffs of their designer hiking jackets. The people in there now were out here queuing a moment ago, so now I'm next. But I'm not going to go in, because why the hell were they waiting if I'm not meant to wait now? Just go in, barked the rudest woman. Very much fearing I was about to take a swing at her if I didn't, I stepped over the threshold without putting on my mask. You'll need a mask, she called. And the slightly less rude woman snorted with pleasure as they both gave each other a look that said, another COVIDiot. Swearing under my breath, I muzzled myself. When I got to the counter, I decided to point out to the lady behind it that there was a degree of ambiguity outside. What? She snapped. She didn't have a mask on, so I could see her scowl. Do you want us to queue or come straight in? We want you inside, ideally. Never mind, I said, for the two rude women were bearing down on me. They had pushed their way round the aisles of bric-a-brac they couldn't buy, a cushion with a fox on it, a mug with a fox on it, a book about walking, a doormat with a fox on it, and were now burning a hole in my back with their accusing pillar of the local residents' association eyes. I ordered lattes for me and the friend who had not yet arrived to stand outside in the street for 10 minutes on her birthday. Whether or not that is illegal, I couldn't work out if I wanted to. I was told my lattes would be deposited on the collection table by the exit. As I was standing there, waiting for tiny, underfilled paper cups of overpriced coffee, the rude women waltzed over and planted themselves inches from where I was standing, then looked at me as though I were invading their personal space, so I had to move as they chatted. Have you had your jab, Marjorie? Yes, I've had it for my country, and so on. The rudest one pointed at the wall. Look, Marjorie, this is the photo of Paul Weller I was telling you about. Oh yes, Paul Weller comes here all the time, you know. As I took my coffees to leave, I saw that outside, Paul Weller stood quietly by the door of the cafe, sipping his coffee. I could see that, but the battle axes were oblivious. Any minute now, they would flounce out the door, telling each other their best Paul Weller stories as they pushed Paul Weller aside.
That was Melissa Kyton. That's everything for this week's episode. But if you enjoy our podcasts, then why not switch over to our special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots, where I'm speaking to Frances Elliott, who was for 11 years political editor of The Times, about the deep secrets, likes and loves of a political lobby journalist. Thanks for listening to this episode, and thanks to Max Jeffrey, our producer. If you ever get any feedback about the Spectator podcasts, then do email us at podcast@spectator.co.uk. We read every single email and always love to hear from you. Thank you.